Health and Human Services to order this Monday, April 11th, 2005. We have three bills up this morning. House Bill 3226, which is a bill that provides support for mental health and addiction services for seniors and persons with disabilities. House Bill 3227, which is a task force for those underserved populations. And House Bill 3219, which deals with reciprocal licensure for denturists. We're going to take them out of order. We'll call. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3219, and we'll call forward Joe Koss, Jim Davis, and Sue Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair, what are we starting? 3219.
3219.
Thank you.
The insurance bill. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And as they're getting settled, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I attached behind the SMS an email testimony from Mr. Cross. I don't know if that's what he's going to. Koss, excuse me, if you're going to be speaking to the same thing or if this was supplemental.
That was a letter that I had written.
Yes.
Prior to the testimony, though. Okay. It's going to be different.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I might just go ahead and start this off. I'm Jim Davis. I'm here representing the Oregon State Denturist Association, United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, and the Great Panthers. We want to express our support for House Bill 3219, which would institute a reciprocity process for state denturist licensure through the Office of Health Licensing. To be able to issue license to practice denture technology to applicants licensed as denturists in states or territories with an equivalent examination, and also gives the Board of Denture Technology the ability to make some necessary adaptations in the state licensing process for denturists. House Bill 3219 creates an immediate reciprocal arrangement, particularly with Washington State, allowing for easier access for denturists to practice in either state, and will provide more examination opportunities for both states. The language in the bill states that any territory or state that has a similar equivalent educational and licensing process and testing process could have a reciprocity agreement with Oregon. You need to understand there's only about a half a dozen states in the United States that have licensure of denturists, so it's not going to be a run on the state, and some of those states actually don't necessarily have equivalent. Oregon is one is the pioneer in terms of the development of their denturist program, and their licensure process is a model nationally. And Washington State, I actually helped, and Ken Holden, who will be coming up later, helped write the law in Washington State. So the two programs are very, very similar. Actually, Washington State was developed even as an even more ideal model in some ways, but then we ultimately passed partials. So both states really have equivalent laws, and the state boards of technology in both states are developing similar licensure examinations, which my two compatriots here will talk about in a minute, that will ultimately allow prospective denturist licensees to take the licensure examination in either Oregon or Washington and have the ability to practice in one or both states. Some people would choose potentially to practice, particularly in the metropolitan area, in both states, and it would give them that opportunity. And here in Oregon, we have a kind of a in some areas, a shortage of denturists, and the numbers have stayed pretty solid, and actually gone down some. And so we'd like to see more denturists actually coming into the state. We'd like to have denturists from Washington State have that opportunity. But at the same time, Washington State needs denturists, and they could go up into that state as well. The legislation also gives the Office of Health Licensing the discretion to add subjects to the licensing examination that reflect changes in industry technology. The health delivery systems, client safety, scientific infection control and other potential advances in the field. Just gives them the flexibility to make these changes. There are constant changes in any health field, and denture technology is certainly no exception. There's been some major advances and in the work that our denturists are doing. The State Board needs the flexibility to adapt licensing examination to the most updated changes occurring in the field. And finally, HB 3219 provides the Department of Denture Technology with the flexibility to determine on a case-by-case basis what level of additional client clinical and laboratory training needed for an applicant who fails the state licensure examination, rather than the real steadfast requirement that's currently in law that requires an additional 1,000 hours in the field if you fail the professional examination. There's virtually no field that I know of that essentially requires an individual to go back out in the field for 6 months. Now, there could be individuals that should go out in the field for 6 months more, but there are others that might have just missed a part of the examination and need work in a certain area. And so what we're dealing with is that the Board of Denture Technology, working with the Office of Health Licensing, should be able to determine on a case-by-case basis which of these candidates should, you know, have however many additional hours after failing an examination. Most of our denturists in the state are older individuals and even come into the field oftentimes in their 30s and 40s. They may have been denture specialists, had their own lab in any number of different opportunities they might have been involved in. So to ask an individual like that to stop his life for another 6 months after he's already gone through 2 years of college training and 6 months in the field, it seems a little harsh. And so we wanted the ability of the board to be able to determine the different needs for supplemental training dependent on an individual's situations and their particular deficiencies. So we strongly urge you to support House Bill 3219. At this point, we know of no opposition. It really is just a bill that would help the field.
I think we'll hear some opposition shortly.
Okay. I bet you I know where that's from.
All right. Thanks, Jim, very much.
Thank you.
Who's next, Joe? Or
you want to go next?
Go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Dalto, representatives of the committee, I'm Joe Koss. I'm a consumer representative and current chair of the Board of Denture Technology, and that's the body that oversees the practice of denturism in Oregon. I've been a member of the board since 2001, and I've been the chair of the board since 2002. Rather than go ahead and repeat a lot of what Jim has already said, I'm just going to highlight a few things that I think need to be kept in mind when looking at the way that House Bill 3219 is intended to modify the Denturist Practices Act. First of all, with regards to the examination and requiring that a denturist from out of state who is licensed in that state have equivalent academic background, it should be noted that Oregon's requirements within the academic areas are as stringent as those in any other state. So if they can, in fact, demonstrate that in their state they did as much as they've done in Oregon, well, they've done as much as anybody else could ever expect in order to prepare to be a denturist in the state of Oregon as well. Also looking at the academic requirements, as you will see in the bill itself, an associate degree is required or an equivalent to 103 total credit hours in an approved program from a state-approved source. And if you take that and divide the numbers out, that equates to about 34 three-hour courses. And you divide that by 15 credit hours a term, you know, you're talking about quite a bit of actual time in the classroom to prepare to be a denturist. And I have attached to my testimony an itemization of exactly what coursework is required of a denturist candidate in the state and how many hours of coursework are required. Speaking a little bit to the examination itself, the examination that a denturist must take in order to pass for his license is a 370-question examination. And in checking with the folks at the Board of Denture Technology or through the Health Licensing Office, we found that it takes a candidate an average of about 4 hours to complete this examination. Part of it is a written examination, multiple choice, and the other part of it is to examine photographs of oral pathology and to discuss and describe what they see. And this, again, is a rigorous examination, and if a denturist from another part of the country can demonstrate that they have been tested at that same level elsewhere, then, you know, they have done a very complete job of demonstrating that they're qualified to practice denture technology. It's important, I think, also to understand that House Bill 3219 does not, in and of itself, allow denturists from another state to receive a license to practice in Oregon. What it does is it establishes a foundation upon which the Board of Denture Technology and the Health Licensing Agency can begin to build reciprocal relationships with other states to allow qualified denturists to serve Oregon residents. Finally, I'd like to make a couple of comments about the 1,000-hour modification that is listed as a proposal in this bill. The board, you know, we believe that to arbitrarily require one to complete 1,000 hours of additional practical training, as the statute now requires, is oftentimes unjustifiable. Candidates, as Jim has mentioned, who take the practical examination and fail it for some technical reason, or they just have a bad day, and we know that they know how to do the work. Those folks are being unnecessarily penalized, in our opinion, to have to take the 1,000 hours arbitrarily and then come back and take the examination again. The board would prefer to have the ability to review the results of their examination and determine additional practical training needed in order to improve that person's performance on subsequent practical exams. Now, this change in no way shortchanges the examination process, because regardless of the number of additional hours of practical training a candidate may obtain, they still must perform satisfactorily during a subsequent practical examination before they obtain their license.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenwood.
Please, hi, Joe.
Hi.
Could you, where's the 1,000-hour deletion on this, on the bill itself?
Where is the 1,000 hours mentioned? It's on page 2.
Yep. Which line?
Do you have a copy?
It's out at the very top.
Yeah,
it's listed lines 1 through 4.
It's a deletion of the 1,000.
Yeah, it's a deletion of the mandatory 1,000,
okay,
and leaves it open to, as determined by the board.
That's line 3.
Yeah.
May I follow up?
Yeah,
could you also, somewhere in your testimony, talk a little bit about line 36 and 37, the deletion on that? And I'm not sure whether you mentioned it or not, Jim. Page 2, the deletion of 6 on...
shall not prescribe minimum education training requirements in excess of those specified in. Yeah. I think that's something that that Sue Wilson can probably speak to best. We talked about this in our board meetings, and I think that you probably have the best handle on the discussion behind that. Correct? On the deletion.
That. Just flexibility by rule.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
We'll get to it in the next.
Okay, and finally, I'll just wrap up by stating that for more than 20 years, Oregon's denturists have been providing safe and high-quality denture services to literally thousands of satisfied patients. These practitioners have been held to high levels of accountability by the state, by their peers, and by other oral health care professions. And that the changes in Oregon statute that are requested in House Bill 3219 are a significant step in the process of building the capacity within the state to meet this ever-increasing demand that's being placed upon it for qualified denturists. Thank you very much for your time, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Well, thanks, Joe. Comments? Okay, Sue, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Dalton, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Susan Wilson. I'm the director for the Health Licensing Agency. We're the state consumer protection agency that provides central agency services for health and related professional boards. We currently license approximately 15 different professions, 30 different types of licenses, and our goal and mission is to protect the public we do that by making sure that there's consumer protection through education, training, and partnerships, and we also do that by making sure we're monitoring through an enforcement staff and making sure that the consumer is protected through that means. We also support the effort of reducing any barriers as much as possible through reciprocity agreements, and we do that as they connect with public safety. We want to make sure that the public safety portion is protected, and we can safely say that each individual that's practicing in the state of Oregon has minimum requirements. We believe the changes to this bill meet those standards that we've had for other professions within our licensing office. What it does is it opens the door to people proving that they have the same satisfactory educational and professional requirements through passage of a clinical and written examination, and just opens the door for individuals to practice in that capacity. The legislation proposes in several areas adjusting the current language. I believe that Representative Greenwick is looking at section 6, line 36. I think this was a redundancy we just took out of the law. I don't think it's going to change anything with the additions in the in bold that you're seeing. And I can get more information if you'd like me to from my...
If I can ask a question, sir.
Sure.
Well, I assume this means if you take this away that that would allow the health licensing office to prescribe minimal requirements in excess of those specified in 680.515, and I wonder whether you had some interest in doing so.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what it allows is in consultation with the board, and yes, we do this in other areas for other boards, so we feel comfortable with that change.
So this would now allow you to add qualifications beyond what's in that.
Definitely, through rule.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right, thanks very much. Next, I'll invite Jane Myers forward, the Oregon Dental Association. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, with some comments opposing the bill. As was pointed out, not very many states recognize the practice of denture technology, and so consequently, there aren't very many accredited programs. Most of those who were licensed in Oregon, last time I reviewed it, had attained the requirement so they could take the exam by the state looking at the whether or not they had met substantially similar requirements to the educational requirements that are the associate degree, because there's there aren't very many programs in the United States that have an associate degree. There used to be one in Oregon, but it was its degree granting authority was taken away many years ago. So we don't really know how many of the denturists who are licensed here currently went through the Washington State School. That's the only one I know of in the United States. So that's a difference, because there are a lot of dental schools in the United States that have accreditation procedures. So that's a major difference. And one concern is whether the board has established adequate educational requirements for the removable partial dentures, which were added to the scope of the dentures a few years ago. And when they've done that by rule, how it would be interpreted with this statute. Another concern is how the board will determine what is substantially similar, since there's no national exam, as there is for the dentists, hygienists, and dental assistants. The board also operates under a mentor model for its for the clinical or practical part of the training, where they may ask a denturist who's already licensed may take a student and train them in their lab. And because of that, it's difficult to evaluate what the training standards actually are. It's difficult to maintain some sort of uniformity because of that mentor relationship. Second, the bill as it's written doesn't allow the health licensing office to refuse licensure if you meet these requirements. And I mean, most boards have at some point come to the legislature and asked for a change that would allow them to refuse to license a candidate, an applicant from another state, even if they meet all the requirements. In the case where the applicant is has been disciplined, and the reflection is that wouldn't necessarily be a wise decision to let them practice in Oregon, or is in the middle of a disciplinary process. So the health licensing office should have discretion to also refuse to renew someone's license. If, for instance, there's a resident, non-resident of this state, resident of Washington, maintaining a license in our state, who also runs into some disciplinary problems. Because, I mean, we've seen that in other licensing applications where a person who doesn't live in the state of Oregon but carries a license here and gets in trouble in that state moves here and then begins practice. And it's not necessarily in the best interest of the public of that. In that situation.
May I ask the chair?
Representative May.
Thank you. Jane, I can understand your point about if there's a record of discipline or in the midst of a disciplinary action. What else might not be in the best interest of the public?
Well, the deletion of clinical hours of practice, the 1,000 hours, if a person fails an exam. I didn't hear any evidence about what the pass rate is on the exam. I guess there's a philosophical difference in training and how people are trained. Most healthcare practitioners or in their training models in the United States have very stringent kind of schools with accreditation and all those standards. And the denturists have, because they're licensed in so few states, they don't have those kinds of standards. So when they remove the 1,000 hours of clinical, if they fail the exam and the exam rate failure is high, is higher than what you'd like to see in the state, then you run the risk of the board, which is pretty much controlled by the denturists or more denturists on the board than anyone else, may not require enough public, may not require enough more training to get the person trained to be licensed.
And the bill, section 2, line 10, it says has satisfied the educational requirements established by the law, and then further down has passed a written examination. So you think that we need something more than that?
Well, I guess the philosophical difference, yes, Chair Dalton, Representative Tomei, is that the person coming from licensure in another state should be required to take the licensing exam in the state of Oregon, too. That seems like a bare minimum requirement to the association. Given that there is so much...
But it says, may I follow?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Written examination that is substantially similar to the examination required for licensure in this state.
Written, yes.
Written exam. And the educational requirements are the same as in Oregon.
My understanding of the way this is written is passed a written exam that's substantially similar. There is also already in the Oregon statute in 680.515, I believe it's section 2, which allows the health licensing office to, if a person hasn't been able to meet the educational standards that are in the first part of that section of the statute, that the health licensing office can make a determination that the individual's education meets Oregon standards. So they can look at what courses they already have taken. That part's in there. So we have a In one case, we have an associate degree program required, which, granted, there are very few associate degree programs, and then we allow the health licensing office to say, well, okay, they've taken a course in this and this and this, and so they meet those requirements by what is basically a substantially similar educational process. I don't know if that answers your question. The written exam is to be substantially similar, which I guess brings up another question, is proprietary rights of exams. Since you have such a small number of states conducting exams, written exams, if a candidate questions the fact whether their exam that they took is substantially similar, doesn't that put the state kind of in an awkward situation of, here's the exam, it's now on the public record, and so is the exam from the other state, in order to make that determination? I think there needs to be some protection for the health licensing office to make determinations without revealing to students, well, if you question it often enough, pretty soon you have all the examination questions that may be available, which diminishes the value of the exam and ends up costing the licensees who are paying for the board more money to develop more exams.
Okay, thank you, Jane. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane, I'm just curious, is there reciprocal licenses for dentists and hygienists between the state of Washington and the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, there are a great many. You can be licensed in the state of Oregon if you have a license in another state, if you meet certain hourly requirements. You can be licensed here if you have taken an exam that is accepted by the Board of Dentistry, which there are mostly regional exams conducted for dentistry. There are four of them. So if you have taken, there are two that are accepted by the board at the moment. In their discretion, they think those exams are adequate exams, and they are the people who conduct these exams and, you know, see the candidates and what's being examined. So if a dentist has, or a dentist applicant for the licensure, and dental hygienists too fall under this, has taken the Western Regional or the Central Regional, they can be licensed here without taking an additional exam. Or they may come in through licensure without further exam. Any state license will let them come to practice here, or, you know, apply for licensure here if they've met, and I think it's like 5 hours or 5 years of experience. The idea behind that was that you gain some advantage in being able to assess whether the person is adequately trained by the fact that even if they didn't take the same licensure exam, some states have their own, that by their experience you can tell whether they're likely to present problems to serving the public safety interests is, after all, what the Board of Dentistry is authorized to protect. I hope that answers your question.
I guess it maybe doesn't. Then what would be, since there sounds like there's a regional test that Oregon has agreed that Washington dentists have probably taken, and so we look at that, or 5 years of history, what do you think would be reasonable process to approve the dentures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't know that I'm really prepared to answer your question on that. I mean, the members of the association feel like the taking the clinical part of the exam is really important to determine, especially now that partial dentures were added to, that's quite an extensive addition to scope. But it really would be important to take the clinical exam. I guess I'm not prepared to give you an answer about how would you make sure that the clinical and the written are all substantially similar for the, I think there's six states, without doing a real research project about looking at those exams and what's the rate of passage on those exams. I mean, to determine how difficult they are, or do all the states license for partial dentures, or do they just license for what we call complete or full dentures, as they're called sometimes?
Yes, follow up.
I think this will be the last one. So just so I understand, having worked in an orthodontist office when I was about 17 or 18 and worked in the lab, we're talking about two different... You knew it. We're talking about two different exams. A written exam of my knowledge, correct, on all those things. And then the other exam is actually making the dentures the physical part of what's going to go in somebody's mouth, correct? And just so I understand, the deletion of the $1,000 or 1,000 hours of additional education is if I fail that physical portion of performance, I'm not required to take 1,000 more clinical hours to improve my skills before I come back and take this exam again. Is that what we're talking about here?
That is the way I understand this bill, yes.
I'm quite finished with this bill, but go ahead.
This is in response in part to what Representative Cameron was asking. It isn't just 5 years. It's those 5 years with several hundred hours. I think it's 700 hours of practical experience that's required here for the licensure, the reciprocal licensing of dentists, just for note of clarification. So it's actually numbers of hours served.
If you want a note of clarification, the Board of Dentistry, I mean, there may be some other ways to look at this. The Board of Dentistry allows the applicant to take the exam again, but there are limits on that. And then at that point, the Western Regional or the Central Regional Boards, which are composed of dentists and hygienists, they decide what the extra work must be. I mean, you know, there's the intent of those exams is kind of a bare threshold. I think most people would agree, and this isn't to disparage any professional, that the exam is just a threshold to let people begin to work in the state. I mean, hopefully experience makes them even better professionals, but to diminish any kind of hourly requirements or to not make sure that we have a good threshold is, we're just not real comfortable with doing that.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jane. Was there anybody in the audience that didn't get a chance to sign up on this bill that wanted to speak? You might have signed up on another one, but come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Ken Holden. I'm a Oregon State insurist, and I'm here in support of this. My association is, and the reciprocity agreement, Jim and I wrote the Washington bill, and we put that into their bill because that was one of the problems we ran into in Montana and some of the other states, was that they wanted us to come up and to practice there. And initially when we wrote the bills, everyone was trying to protect their turf, and they didn't want everyone coming pell-mell across the border. And then what they ran into is that there was no one to come. They couldn't replenish themselves, and so a lot of guys who would have been happy to practice, say, in Montana or Washington, couldn't. So when we put this into the Washington bill, we put in there that you could practice in either state, and that the requirement was that you had to have approximately the same type of education and requirements and so forth. I'm licensed in the state of Washington. I've been practicing now for almost 30 years, and I presently have a license in the state of Washington, and when I made my application, they looked at my experience, they looked at my requirements and so forth, and I was granted a license there. It would just be really a real boon for denturists, and also a plus for the state of Oregon, because it would allow denturists who are trained there to come down here as well, and vice versa. The other thing is that on the testing, one of the things that has been a problem for us is that many times we'll have the examination, say, it's in July, and there's not going to be another clinical for a whole year. And so then the person, if they don't get their education done just at the right time, or they're not quite ready for it or whatever, and or if they fail the examination, it means they have to wait a full year before they can take the exam. And we've been in discussion with the state of Washington, and we're this way we can stagger it. And so maybe they can take the exam in May in the state of Washington, and if for some reason they fail on the clinical or have a problem there, then it gives them the option then to come in and take it here in Oregon in, say, July. But the examinations and so forth are basically identical and the same. The other aspect on the legislation is to change the exam to reflect the technology. When I first started, implants weren't even out there hardly. We had extremely difficult, archaic implants compared to what we have today, which is just incredible. And so the technology is changing constantly and all the time, and it's great for the board to be able to look and say, you know, this is new technology that's come along, and if you're going to be getting into this technology, you will take some additional classes and so forth. And so that would really help us out to be able to do that as well. The 1,000-hour requirement, that again is just a really difficult imposition. I gave the exam the last go around, and one lady who this is her second go at it, she failed on one tiny little aspect, and yet her work was beautiful. She did really nice work, and I really felt sorry for her when we failed her on this one thing, but we're kind of in a straitjacket here. And for the board then to be able to look at each individual case and to assess what this person needs, if it's in a particular area, this person had missed the bite, which is critical. But why couldn't we have had some additional requirement for her that she come back and she could take some additional classes in that particular thing or have trained. The examinations that we have and much of the program is, we do have mentoring, and it works, and it's great for a denturist to have a technician or a potential denturist who's coming through the program. For instance, my son right now is mentoring with me, and he's going through the school at George Brown College in Toronto, Canada. It's very expensive. We fly him up there, and it's been costing us a lot of money, but the program is excellent, and so far the pass ratio from George Brown College has been excellent. Dr. Akias, who's the administrator of the Bates College, is doing a fine program. He's been in contact with our boards. They're trying to make everything as close as possible so that there'll be a smooth transition between either state. And Bates College is working out very well. I think it's kind of interesting. In many of the dental colleges right now, a lot of the dentists aren't even trained in dentures. And in fact, it's usually the prosthodontist who's gone on farther and has picked up, specialized in the area of removal prosthetics. And dentists have this ability with their regional exams and so forth. And this is what this will do. And yes, we only have six states, but the time is going to come when that will gradually expand. But it makes it so that individuals who would like to live in our state, and or if I would like to go up and practice in the state of Washington, right now I can do so simply because reciprocity is in there. And we would sure like to see this passed, and it would just clean up things and make things a lot better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope I didn't miss the answer to these questions when I just stepped out a moment ago. As I remember, the dentures law was put in by a vote of the people. Is that right? It was an initiative. May I just follow on that?
Just go ahead.
How many dentures do we have?
Well, initially we had as high as 150, and I think we're down around 130. And it's pretty much stayed within that scope.
And I think one final question. Yeah, how's the rural-urban mix on this? Is this basically an urban phenomenon? Or
we have dentists in Baker. We have them in Ontario. We have them in Bend. We have them in Klamath Falls. We have them in, they're everywhere. And providing them services all the way down Port Orford and in that area down there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenley. Okay. Thanks very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3219 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3226. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, 3226 is providing support for mental health and addiction services for seniors and persons with disability. It declares an emergency effective July 1st this year. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Do we know if Representative March is available?
He said if we wanted him here, if he's in Ways and Means, we certainly will get him. But he's comfortable with the panel that's here to speak to the bill.
Terrific. We'll invite Jim Davis and Wilma Gritton forward, please.
Can I bring Porter come up, too?
Sure.
No, the only 1,000 is 1,000 if they fail the exam.
Okay.
Good morning, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, Save Oregon Seniors, and the Great Panthers. We are here today as part of the Coalition for Responsible Treatment, which creates a very unique partnership of over 20 organizations statewide dealing with the underserved populations within the mental health and addictions systems. Our coalition wants to energize advocates and consumers to push for more reasonable levels of mental health services to enable seniors, people with disabilities, and ethnic minorities to meet their special mental health and addiction needs. We're here to express our very strong support for House Bill 3226, which provides a policy statement of support for the initiation of mental health and addiction services for seniors and people with disabilities through a coordinated and comprehensive network of services, education, and treatment, including mental health therapy, counseling, assessments, screenings, outpatient treatment, multilingual and cultural services, and then educational services within the community. Senate Bill 3226 is meant to be an updating and extension of the current policy statement on senior mental health and addictions in the SPD DHS statutes. And I actually, as a psychologist, have helped write that aspect of the statutes, and it passed in the 1990s, so with great support from senior advocacy groups. And so really what we want to do is go back in and beef up that aspect of the statute that discusses a vision for senior and disability mental health and addiction. We are not asking for any money. The appropriations vehicle that we had, which was 3228, we have killed that, and this has all been in discussion with Chair Dalto, that we are not pursuing any kind of money, that really what we want to do is make this statement a more comprehensive statement in statute, and we really want the committee to rescind the Ways and Means referral and move this to the floor of the House. We can assure you we're not asking for anything. What this really is a culmination of an involved process through the Coalition for Responsible Treatment. We held two very successful forums, one on senior mental health and addiction and one on disability mental health and addiction. And we filled the rooms. We had, 70 to 80 people at advocates and policy people and consumers at these forums. And it was through this agreement, that we reached and all the brainstorming that we did, that we reached the agreement to develop these pieces of legislation to reach out, in particular in this instance, to seniors and people with disabilities. I think as you, and I might just also add that the changes in this bill also, and I don't know if I've mentioned this, it only creates the kind of vision, a more enhanced vision, but it also adds people with disabilities, because right now the statute, this policy statement within statute really only covers seniors, and our system is a dual system with seniors and people with disabilities, and we really wanted to make sure that the language dealt with both populations. I think, as probably many of you are aware, that seniors and people with disabilities, face a much higher rate of mental illness and addictions and are almost completely alienated from the current mental health and addictions system. Seniors and people with disabilities face significant losses, physical and emotional health problems, life adjustments and transitions that put them at the highest level of risk for depression and anxiety, also potentially mild paranoid incidents, sleep disturbances, hypochondria, other difficulties that these populations face. And a lot of those are faced and proven clinically for the senior population, but certainly people with disabilities face very similar mental health problems. They face the adjustments with their physical mobility and all the difficulty they have just living. And as a result, they have very high anger and depression rates, and but are often afraid to go seek any help because they don't like the double stigma. And so when we went searching for materials about disability, physical disability, mental health, and addiction, there was virtually nothing out there, virtually nothing anywhere that even discusses it. And I went to a number of different advocates, and I said, well, why is this? I mean, why, you know, this certainly would obviously be a problem in this population. And they said, well, we don't want the double stigma. We already have the stigma of being physically disabled. We don't want this stigma of being mentally disabled as well. And so a lot of times they're not even seeking the help. But if they did seek the help, what they would find, as well as what seniors find, is that they are going to, oftentimes, mental health professionals and clinics that aren't necessarily prepared to deal with their specific problems, and they're not really dealing with those populations. We're looking at now probably 15 to 25% of the senior population, probably very similar numbers within the disability population, who have mental health or addiction problems that need response. Among seniors, the alcohol problem is very much a hidden problem. You know, they're in their homes. A lot of people aren't seeing them, and doctors think that some of the signs they're showing are just signs of aging, and they're not realizing that what they're seeing is an addiction problem or potentially a depression problem, and then there's not adequate response. I think many of you during the interim were very surprised to hear senior suicide statistics. Well, we've been looking at these statistics for decades, and seniors have the highest rate of suicide of any population, right up there with teen suicides, but even more so. And they're more successful in their suicides. They account for 25 to 30% of all successful suicides, and they only make up 13% of the population. So you can see that there's a massive problem there, and I believe a lot of that falls on the fact that there's nowhere for them to turn when they have serious mental health and addiction problems. With the people with disabilities, there's no question in our mind that rates are very similar, but we don't have data, and we need data. And you go into the public or private sector, what you're going to see is in the public sector with community mental health programs, less than 5% of their clientele are seniors. In the private market, it's even less. And in alcohol and drug, virtually no response in the alcohol and drug area. We were looking a few years back at the Oregon Health Plan. We saw they had somewhere in the neighborhood, and I'm just like trying to pull this out of my head now, 36,000 people that they had reached over a certain period of time. 150 of those were seniors. And some of them were just surviving heroin addicts that lived to old age, and there virtually was no response. And that, to us, is a very, very sad situation. I had the honor, as a psychologist and gerontologist, to head up and coordinate the state senior mental health and addiction projects for 12 years. We did a tremendous job of reaching out into the senior community with preventative approaches, with individual and group counseling, with assessments, with consultation, with education, and we reached thousands. I brought the data here for you. We reached over with the legislature gave us $1 million, a little over $1 million. We matched it with another $3 million. It was a tremendously successful program. We reached over 6,000 seniors, 11,000 service providers. We were really making an impact. And in 2001, the projects were eliminated. And we thought it was a foot in the door. We thought it was an opportunity for us to be able to then reach out to the rest of the state. And now there really is very little, if any, organized effort. Some of our projects still exist in part because they were able to match it with other funds. But now there's virtually no organized effort to reach out to these underserved population. So we really feel that the development of a basic senior disability mental health and alcohol and drug service system is essential, and that it's just absolutely so very unfortunate this population is being completely ignored. We should be reaching out with cost-effective and creative approaches, early intervention approaches, so that we don't ultimately have to pay the price on the other end when these seniors are ending up in nursing homes or ending up in other levels of care that are far beyond what they would need. I had the opportunity to do studies on this of the people involved in these projects, and we found that even with a small number of people, we made back the money that we paid for these projects because of where they would have been had we not reached out to them, the earlier stages of depression, the earlier stages of difficulty, and been able to help them. So we strongly urge you to move 3226 to the floor without a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We'd like to have a stronger statement in the law about initiating senior and disability mental health and addiction services. Thank you.
Jim, I think I missed this, but can you tell me exactly how we deleted the fiscal impact?
Of how, excuse, Mr. Chair, excuse me?
Yeah, with this bill, how the fiscal impact was taken out so that we could justify the retaining of the Ways and Means.
Oh, are you asking how you would go about doing this?
Yeah, are you asking for an amendment to change some language?
Well, no, what we're saying is that the bill doesn't have a fiscal impact. It is simply a policy statement. I mean, we're not asking for anything. We had, and we can attest to that by the fact that we actually had a separate bill that was had very similar wording that had an appropriation aspect to it, and we have killed that bill. So the only thing we're carrying forward is the policy statement. We're not asking for any money. We're not pushing Ways and Means for anything. We're simply asking for a policy statement that be put into law. We certainly would like, frankly, to see community mental health and other mental health interests begin to reach out more to seniors, but we are certainly not asking for any kind of appropriation to go along with this.
On this policy statement, then, that we have here, would you can you approach the department to get them to have some indication to us that there isn't any sort of fiscal so that we can get that rescinding taken care of?
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that. Are you referring, if I might ask, to going to the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division or to DHS as a whole?
I would say DHS. We can help you with that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, then Cameron, then Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then me, sir.
Jim, so seniors with mental health issues, alcohol and drug issues, are these issues that developed earlier in their lives and are just becoming more obvious now, or are these ones that developed in their senior years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, actually, in most cases, these are difficulties that develop in their later years. Some certainly have experienced depression and anxiety in their middle years, earlier years, and they're carrying with them problems that they've had in the earlier years. I mean, seniors are just simply the extension of who they were in their younger and middle years. So certainly they will carry with them many of the dilemmas they faced earlier. But what happens in retirement is that older people are facing one adjustment on top of the other. So they come into retirement completely unprepared. Our society does not adequately prepare individuals to retire, and with the all the other aspects of retirement besides the financial aspect. And so they come in with at least 85% have some kind of chronic physical illness. They often find that they don't have the financial resources they thought they were going to have. They see people around them, loved ones around them, dying. They're experiencing adjustments, maybe having to move into other living environments. But different from younger people, they experience these adjustments one on top of the other. And lots of people, lots of losses, lots of adjustments around them. So it makes sense that they would suffer a higher level of depression and anxiety because of those adjustments and because we live in a society that doesn't adequately prepare people to grow old.
Thank you. Jim, I heard some of this testimony during the interim, and as I recall, I think I had asked you, I had assumed the higher rate of suicide was due to people having terminal illnesses. And as I recall, you said that was not the case.
No, actually, Representative Tomei, Mr. Chair, that in some cases it is. You know, a lot of cases where you see end-of-life issues, it is because of terminal illness, absolutely. And a lot of the issues around suicide with all ages deal with terminal illness. But in terms of the senior population, they just have the highest rate of suicide, period, that does not necessarily related to terminal illness. Actually, the highest rate of suicide is among white, older males. They have the very highest rate of suicide. And it's usually for a lot of reasons. You know, lack of ability to adjust to their current situations, depression, losses, significant losses in their lives. So there are a lot of factors involved with that.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a
little clarification. So this is a policy statement that you're trying to pass. When you make a statement of policy, don't you also have to follow through with implementing that policy? Isn't that the objective and the goal here?
Well, Representative Cameron, Mr. Chair, that certainly is our hope in the future, that ultimately there will be efforts made to implement a system that will reach out to seniors and people with disabilities. But at this point, we're really looking at it as more of a vision, and actually what we want to do is we want, and that's what the law states, we don't know if exactly it's happening every go-around, but essentially this aspect of the law is talking about in planning and strategy processes within DHS that they will consider the mental health and addiction needs of seniors and now people with disabilities. So what we're looking at is not only to develop a more comprehensive approach to these populations, but we also in process of planning the services that already currently exist, they need to be thinking about older people and people with disabilities as Oregon citizens who should have a right to share in these services. But no, sir, we're not asking for anything now. We're really enhancing a policy statement, but in the future we certainly would like to come back and when in better economic times and see that more is being done in this area.
I just can't imagine passing a policy and not looking at what it costs to implement that policy. I mean, I don't understand that. Maybe you can help clarify that for me.
Representative Cameron, at this point, we certainly could outline to you, you know, what it would cost, depending on how many people you'd reach and how many counties. We could look at what it would cost, depending on the level of services that you would provide, because there could be any number of costs that could be associated with that once you came up with an actual concrete plan. This is really just a general statement of conviction and vision around this issue. But for instance, with our mental health projects that we had over a 12-year period, we didn't get much money with that, but we were able to do early intervention approaches. We got $1 million, which added up to about, you know, less than $200,000 every biennium, that we then matched against other funds, and we were able to go out and do some basic level services and approaches in 15 different counties. And so for a pretty small amount of money, but certainly there needs to be more far-reaching efforts to reach out to these populations. And usually, and we're looking more through the senior and disability service system, because a lot of times people are fearful of the ramification of jumping to another system. So we'd have to have some of those kind of considerations. But at this point, it is only a vision. It was only an effort to kind of beef up policy that is already sitting in statute to include people with disabilities and maybe enhance that vision a little further.
Could we change line 5 then to it is the vision?
I don't have the bill in front of me. I don't have that. I don't.
Instead of it is the policy?
Forgive me.
Here's a kind of, it's existing statute.
And what line, sir?
Well, just line 5, page 1.
Line 5, page 1. Well, I suppose, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I suppose you could do that. I think it would somewhat weaken it, because I'd like to see it be a policy within the department. But certainly you could say it was a vision, because that is what it is. It is really a vision for the future. It's a policy vision for the future.
There you go.
But I would certainly be willing to consider that. Thank you.
Representative Cameron, don't get getting all practical on us.
Representative Butler, Greenlick, and Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm concerned about some of the things, same things that you've expressed concern about. I just want to make sure that those are on the record. I'd like to know what the Department of Human Services response to this whole issue is. Also, down with regard to item E on lines 22 and 23, this provides that the program, or that the department will develop a program of education and consulting services for primary care physicians treating seniors and persons with disabilities. I am very anxious about what the Oregon Medical Association made to say to that, wondering if our community colleges have been consulted with regard to education and training for these kinds of areas that are listed on 19 and 20. And finally, Mr. Chair, I have a serious question about the handout which Dr. Davis has given us today. On page 2, it says that the major reason for the lack of attention to these elderly issues has been money, or lack thereof. And now we're saying we want to change this, and I don't want to change it to a vision or policy. I just want to be very careful about how we go about this. The question I have for Mr. Davis is, I need to have a little bit further understanding of what, on line 17 and 18, multicultural medical and psychiatric services might be. I'm concerned about what that might include.
Well,
I just don't want any dead chickens dancing around, those kind of things. You do it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler.
To Hefner yesterday.
If I can respond to that, that would be great. Let me respond to your first two points. It's very important to us to try to reach out into the health professionals who are working with seniors, but also to primary care physicians with education, geriatric education, and particularly education around the difficulties and problems that seniors and people with disabilities are experiencing. In many medical schools, there isn't necessarily as strong a geriatric training aspect as in others. But we're not looking to impinge on the training requirements of doctors or health professionals. Essentially, what we would be trying to do would be outreach efforts to hold community educational workshops and get on cable television and get materials out to people so that they can potentially understand better the services and that are available in their area, that they can understand issues that seniors are facing and some of the reasons that maybe they're coming into their office with certain problems. What our effort is we want to reach out to these health professionals. And as part of the senior mental health and addiction projects that we worked on for 12 years, a major part of that in certain counties was educational programs that we would do, reaching out to anybody who wanted to come, who wanted to listen, so that we could better educate them about more effectively approaching seniors and people with disabilities. So that's all that is. It's really very innocent and is really just a community education effort that we feel would be a part of any program that we would set up. As far as a multicultural, multilingual aspect, in our Coalition for Responsible Treatment, we have a partnership with the ethnic minority community, and so we always try to carry through in our policy statements, appropriate approaches to ethnic minorities, so that if they, you know, for instance, it's a Hispanic senior, that there would be somebody there that would be able to understand if she doesn't speak English well, or if there's other cultural differences where you would need to make sure that you approached it in an appropriate manner to with that senior or person with disabilities. That's all that we're saying there, is that we want to be culturally appropriate in how we approach these services. We want to reach out into the ethnic minority community of seniors and people with disabilities, and we want them to get involved, because oftentimes what we have found is ethnic minorities are oftentimes the most ignored population in a lot of these service arenas. And if you're older or you have a physical disability and you are an ethnic minority as well, it makes it just doubly difficult. So that's really what that aspect is about. Again, this is a vision of some of the things that we'd want to do. And of course, it's a legislative council interpretation of the vision that we gave them, but we think it's well written. We think it covers what we would like to see in this kind of policy vision.
Thank you. Representative Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, this amendment amends Chapter 410 of ORS, and Chapter 410 is the chapter that talks about senior and disabled services, and it defines that. And Chapter 410, number 720, which is what it's amending, the particular chapter, Actually, isn't a bad policy statement right now. It talks about a policy statement that how to coordinate services statewide and a variety of things, and it requires, as Section 2 of Section 720, that in carrying out the provisions of this subsection, the department shall develop plans for service coordination and recommended budget provisions for the delivery of needed services. Well, this is a nice expansion and adds disability as disabled people to it and is more specific. What's your impression on how the department's doing? What are they doing? What are the budget implications? How are they doing on 410, 720 in its current form?
Representative Greenlick and Mr. Chair, I think the policy statement, as it is, because we certainly were very involved in developing this statement, that I think it is a solid statement, but it is. We just don't think it goes quite far enough, and we'd like to see people with disabilities added into it, and we'd like to see a little more discussion of some of the arenas that we might reach out into and provide services. And so this, we feel, is a little more full policy statement.
But that's not my question.
And then you ask how are they doing?
Well,
because I'd be glad to answer that as well.
The issue is that, one of the issues I hear is what are the fiscal implications of changing some language, and one would infer from that, and I think it would be legitimate, that there are some fiscal implications for doing what they're already doing. And I just wondered whether your group or you as a mental health professional have some sense of, are they actually carrying through with the policy statement, with the mission? There is a mission related to it. It says specifically, do programming, do some budgets. How are they doing now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think a lot more could be done. I'm very supportive of seniors and people with disabilities. That department and that division, I always have been, and the mental health division, I used to work for them as a gerontologist, and they certainly they do very, very good work. And the Office of Mental Health Services has a very qualified and capable gerontologist. They're reaching out into the communities as best they can. In the senior and disability arena, after the projects were eliminated in 2001. The projects were the vehicle that we were reaching out around the state. When they were eliminated, what happened is that some AAAs, Area Agencies on Aging, for instance, in Mid-Willamette Valley, they've kept a pretty strong senior mental health program. Down in Lane County, they have Peace Health. They work with Peace Health. They actually work with an HMO in a very interesting partnership. And that they're still working around senior mental health issues. And we funded geriatric mental health specialists down in Southern Oregon, and I'm not certain whether they're still there or not, but I know that in other areas of the state there isn't a lot going on for senior mental health care. In Multnomah County there's a few smaller programs, and there's a few things here or there, but it's hit and miss. It's not adequately reaching the population, and a lot more needs to be done. It's really criminal that we're allowing such a lack of outreach to the senior and disability population around very serious mental health and addiction problems. So I don't think enough is being done, and I'm not certain that when they are developing plans and service coordination, whether they're thinking about these issues. I can't answer that, but I know that it is on their. It's now much more on their radar screen than it was in the past, and I know that it's much more in planning processes and discussions. And because of the economic situation that we've been facing in this state, we've never been able to recreate some of the inroads we had created a number of years ago. So the deficit in the budget has just totally taken away the opportunity for us to develop these programs. I might answer the question about, because it keeps coming up, is this ultimately going to cost money? Well, yes. I think that in the future years, when the economy gets better, and hopefully we begin to invest in better mental health and addiction services for seniors and people with disabilities, yes, ultimately in the future it will cost more money. Yeah, I did write that in that article, and it was a very important point that if you don't invest in these type of services, these populations aren't going to be reached. And so ultimately, yes, we have agreed not to push it this session, but in future sessions, yes, we would like to come back and see that these areas are covered.
If I can follow one more area, sir. As I pointed out, this is in a section on senior and disability service, so it's focusing on seniors and disabled people because it's supposed to. We that are meet the qualifications for services for one reason or another under this thing also have grandchildren that we're very worried about, and we've had many hearings here on the question of mental health for children. My sense is this isn't a piece of intergenerational warfare here. I'm sure you don't in any way intend to diminish the push for making sure the mental health services for children work out simply because you're concerned with straightening out the issue of mental health services for seniors and people with disabilities.
Representative Greenlake, of course not. And actually, we're a member of the Mental Health Matters Coalition, and we're very involved with other mental health groups and very supportive of mental health funding. And actually, I've been involved in my other coalition work in pushing for general mental health issues. But in terms of this policy statement, yes, this is geared towards seniors and people with physical disabilities. And we would envision that the services that would ultimately be developed in the future would go through senior and disability services in partnership with the community mental health system. That's how we've done it in the past. We want a partnership between senior and disability services and community and statewide mental health and addiction services. So with that partnership, we would move forward. But we're thinking, because of questions that are still very much unanswered about shifting between systems, we would want our people to start out in the SPD system and then work through cooperative arrangements with the mental health system.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of the only two true seniors on this panel, I take this very seriously, and I do commend you for the work that you're doing, not only with seniors, but with disability and mental health and A&D. I don't want to beat on a dead pheasant here, but I think I might...
Todd may want to join our bug there.
Well, not quite yet. I think there is some language in here that would trigger some problems for me. In line 10, it says, shall facilitate, DHS shall facilitate, which to me means they're going to be doing some active bringing people together. And then down in line 29, it says, develop plans, which also to me is an action thing. But I think you triggered something that might be the answer to this if we are to keep this out of ways and means, and that is that there may be efficiencies of the department that they're not doing now that could be made more efficient to allow some of these activities. In other words, if they're doing some things that shouldn't be done that could be refocused on this, I see that as a real possibility. Otherwise, I'd have some problems in not going to Ways and Means, even though I'm very much in favor of what you're trying to do.
Thank you, Representative.
If I might just quickly respond, Representative Anderson, we don't see a fiscal impact now, but, you know, in terms of language like facilitate and plan, yes, I mean, when agency people sit around a table and start talking about mental health, we'd like them to talk about seniors and people with disabilities as well. So we're not asking them to add additional staff or anything more at this point, but what we're saying is, yes, we would like you to begin to facilitate some kind of process and thought process and planning process, because right now these people are being ignored out here, and we want you to start thinking about it. But we certainly would be amenable to word changes that would allow us to at least do some beefing up of this policy statement.
Thank you. And Representative Bruin, why not close it out?
Okay.
Everybody else has said something.
I will be brief. I like this bill because it's just a thought process, and it's a new paradigm. And I appreciate the fact that you said some people don't come forward, and for whatever reason it is. But I just wanted to ask. I mean, I know I had a stepmom living in King City, and that's a community of a lot of older people. I lived there myself for 3 months. And I think that maybe, I don't know if you already do this or not, but that's an opportunity to go into a place like that where you have a close community and go into their community center and have a presentation at their whatever their forums are, at their city halls, whatever, so that people know these things are available. and try to start working to kill the stigma at that point, and maybe offer some free workshops or whatever, and just get some, maybe get a group going or something that doesn't cost money, but that starts to address it and lets people know, hey, you know, you're like we are. There's no stigma for age or disability, and make them feel that it's okay, you know, to do that. I don't know if that's already happening or.
Representative Boone, that's an excellent suggestion. That's kind of some of the educational type of programs that we're talking about, really, is trying to reach out into the community to families and seniors and people with disabilities as well as professionals with those kind of messages. And we do want to start going into communities, local communities, and begin setting up things like that. You know, limited resources doesn't allow us to do it to the extent we'd like to, but we are sending our message out wherever we can.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. Wilma?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am Wilma Gritton, a member of the Board of Directors of United Seniors of Oregon and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. Also a former member of the Advisory Board for Nursing Home Ombudsman Program. And there I found out a good deal on this subject. I strongly urge the passage of House Bill 3226, which provides for support of mental health and addiction services for seniors and people with disabilities through mental health therapy, screenings and assessments, outreach services, and educational services for health professionals, consumers, and families. House Bill 3226 is meant to update the policy statement on senior mental health and addictions in the SPD DHS statutes, which senior groups helped pass in the 1990s. It also adds people with disabilities who weren't part of the original language. We also support House Bill 3227, which would develop a task force on the mental health and addiction problems of the underserved populations of seniors, people with disabilities, and ethnic minorities. Something must be done to reach out to seniors and people with disabilities with some level of preventative mental health and addiction services that meets their special needs. But they're being completely alienated from the current service system. I don't think you need to go very far to observe some of these people that you could tell need mental services. They're on the streets, and I have no doubt that some of them that are in penitentiaries should be in a mental hospital rather than where they are. So, seniors and people with disabilities face major losses, physical and emotional health problems, and other adjustments that make them at much greater risk of developing mental health problems, such as depression and anxiety, as Jim said. Not to mention misuse and abuse of alcohol and prescription drugs. That's pretty evident, too. Both groups are far more likely to commit suicide. There are few public or private services for the mental health needs of seniors or people with disabilities where emphasis is placed on the younger and more mobile. There are many limitations to access needed services and virtually no outreach services. The last organized statewide efforts in local communities were the state-funded senior mental health and addiction projects, which were eliminated in 2001. We feel that seniors and people with disabilities suffering from emotional health or addiction problems have a right to at least the basic level of senior and disability mental health and alcohol and drug services. So we do urge you to support House Bill 32 and 3226 and 3227.
Thanks very much. Okay, Verna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Verna Porter. I am a retired geriatric nurse. I'm also currently the president of Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans, and as Jim says, have worked with senior advocacy groups for a few years. I'm probably just going to put a little personal input here. When I graduated from nursing school, the head of the nursing department came up to me on the day we were capped and told me to avoid geriatric care, that I was probably a better nurse than that. You know, that was, there is a stigma. And geriatric care, older people, well, I guess they're just dying anyway. You know, use your skills somewhere else. I didn't go immediately into geriatric care, but then I kind of hadn't found my niche and went with an agency and went to several different places and discovered this is my where I belong. I became a geriatric specialist. Truly, truly love the profession. My personal experiences in life have duplicated many times what I learned as a nurse dealing as a professional with this. I counseled people as a nurse on death and dying. I personally experienced that myself in having lost my husband. The access that I have had to everything I've needed that my husband has needed has been because we have had excellent health care coverage. And my concerns are that if not everyone, more people should have available to them what I had. My husband was diagnosed with colon cancer actually 13 years ago now and survived until just 6 months ago. And an awful lot of that, aside from good physical care, was the counseling and the help that we got to get through the grief process. You know, retiring is a big deal. I mean, I thought my life ended for a while. But the death and dying issue is, you know, yes, everybody has faced it since time began. It's a much bigger deal nowadays. It truly is. We don't have the support of family, churches, et cetera, like we used to have. I can go on, and I'm sure you know I could. But I just want to say is I support so totally what Jim has stated here. And, yes, it is a vision. It's my vision that everyone should have access to the counseling, the alcohol and drug counseling. My generation, we don't think we're addicted to drugs when we take too many pain medications. That's not marijuana or something, you know. I mean, there's a lot of education that needs to be done. I just thank you for listening. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. And, colleagues, I'd like to try to end this at 10:30, if possible, so try to figure out how we can do that. I'll invite Michael Morris, Catherine White, and Gina Furman together, please. Very good. As my committee members escape... Good morning, welcome. We'll start with Michael Morris.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3226. The department supports this bill, the concept of this bill, in regards that we view this as a policy statement, and we support the policy of mental health services to persons with disabilities and seniors. So we support it on the basis of that. We are currently, through ORS 430, the local community mental health authorities are engaged in a planning process that they engage in on a biennial basis, where they outline the services for their population, and we see this as just building upon that process. We do initially had concerns regarding a fiscal impact, but then as further analysis of the bill, we saw this as a policy statement. It does not expand services to seniors and persons with disabilities, but it is strictly a policy statement. So that is the reason that we do not see this as having a fiscal impact. The other concern we have regarding the bill is that it is in ORS 410 and are in ORS 430, which is our outlines of mental health services and addiction services at the local level, provides the basis for a very comprehensive and coordinated mental health planning process, and there is just some concern that this would cause something else to happen. We would probably operationally incorporate this into the local mental health planning process. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, in looking at the bill, I still wonder why most of this can't be done by the agency without additional direction. But in looking at the bill, we're instructed, first under Section 1, we're instructed on line 6, that these are for all Oregon senior citizens. And then on line 7, we're taking out the word senior and making these local network as opposed to a senior network for mental health services. Is it presently the policy of the department that you do not, or that somehow you allow discrimination based upon age relative to mental health programs in the state? Age or ethnic minority? Or physical disabilities or hearing impairments? Is it presently the policy of the department to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, it is not the policy that we discriminate based on age or disability.
So I come back to my original question then. Why do we have to have a new vision or a new policy statement relative to these things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the way that I view this is that these groups recognize the increasing needs of this population, especially seniors and the aging of our population, and would like further emphasis and further attention to this group, as well as groups with disabilities and our growing ethnic diverse population also.
Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable with some of the language that, or some of the discussion about outreaching to these various groups. But my concern is that much of the testimony today that has been given has indicated that somehow we are discriminating against some of these folks based upon age. That the programs one of the folks testified that they do not provide the services, these mental health and addiction services, to seniors. And looking at the senior program or the mental health programs in my constituency, they don't ask about, you know, how old are you so we can cut you off from them. So I'm just anxious about that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Butler. I actually interpreted the testimony slightly differently. My interpretation was a frustration on the part of the advocacy community representing seniors and people with disabilities, saying that we do have a system. We have a system that serves a full spectrum of Oregonians in need, but is deficient in a number of different areas, insufficient in the services that it provides, particularly to these communities. And I think that
you know, short of a remarkable change in the way we fund mental health and addiction services and our resources overall to serve these populations, I understand that they're articulating a vision and saying, look, this is where we want to be. This is what we want to do. We want to help this community, and we feel that they're not being served at the level that they should be. And we're not going to get there right now with the funding, but we do want to make sure that we don't lose a commitment to these particular populations. And I think, in my mind, that's what this policy statement is advancing. It's advancing our continuing commitment to these populations. Not that they're being discriminated against right now, but that they aren't receiving the services because of the lack of resources. So that's my interpretation, and I could be wrong. But when I put my name to this bill, along with, I don't know, a dozen other people, I thought that that was the impression.
And Mr. Chair, I do want to express, again, my appreciation for the testimony that has been involved with regard to outreach, because I think we can do a better job of outreaching to all of the people that are involved here, the hearing impaired, those with physical disabilities, those that have the multilingual issues, those that have psychiatric issues, ethnic issues, multicultural issues, and all of those kinds of things. If we're not doing that, if we're not doing that for seniors, then perhaps we should have a better outreach program. So.
Thank you. Your comments are noted. Any other questions or comments? Okay, Gina, go ahead.
Chair Dalto, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The association is in support of 3226 in concept. We think this is a great bill. I certainly appreciate Dr. Davis bringing this forward, and I believe that Representative Dalto's interpretation of the bill is accurate. We do, however, have some concerns about some of the parts of the bill that we think that can be changed. One is this address is only 410, and some of the additions to this bill we believe would require changes in ORS 430, and that's where mental health and addictions, the process, and we believe some of this would need change in the 430s. Also, in Section 1, Paragraph 2, that would be Line 10, that describes a group, the Department of Human Services shall facilitate the formation of a local community partnerships between, and at last it lists the people that should be there. That already happens. Each community or county has a local alcohol and drug and mental health planning committee. And so that already exists, and we weren't sure if this calls for a new group or a new process, and so we think that that should be clarified.
Madam Chair, name of that committee was?
Well, in statute, it's the Local Alcohol and Drug and Mental Health Planning Committee. However, in each county, they have a different name for it depending on what name that the county gives it. And so it may be the Local Mental Health Planning Committee. It may be the Local Alcohol and Drug. They may have a shortened name for it or a different acronym. But basically, it's that committee that satisfies the committee in ORS 430.
Just a clarification, Madam Chair, that's an outreach program then?
That's actually a committee that gets together and meets on the whole spectrum, from children to seniors, birth to death, and plans for, could plan for outreach, but plans for community services within existing resources.
Thank you.
The other concern that we have is in line 29, when it talks about developing plans for expanding mental health and addiction services, we believe that we already do that. Last year, or last session in House Bill 3024, there was a new planning process that happened. Also, OMAS has been very, very good, Mental Health and Addiction Services, has been very good about people been sitting down, and we have one planning process. There used to be five different planning processes, and we had to fold our plans in together. And so we believe these plans already look at birth to death. I think that Dr. Davis's concern, as well as ours, is that there's not enough funds because there's never been enough funding in the system. We have a children's budget note. There's not enough funding in the children's mental health system in every stage, and seniors have really been overlooked. So there's not additional funding. It's not called out. So we believe that those plans already exist, but they certainly could be added to, and if money was available, so maybe we could put in wording subject to availability of funding, because the plans are there. There's just not enough money to do it. So my concern is that where you say develop plans for expanding mental health, that we don't, you know, get mixed up and take this pot of money away from this population and put it to another population. I think it needs to be worded very carefully. But certainly, Dr. Davis's thoughts and Representative Dalto's interpretation is correct. We have to have some more money in the system to serve seniors the way that they should be served. But within our existing resources, the plans that we currently do serve birth to death the best we can with the little funding that we do have in the system.
Thanks. Catherine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council. And we are in support of this bill in concept. We wanted to point out that by amending only 410, and I know there have been some suggestions to include 430, it only applies to people with physical disabilities. And I wanted to point out that people with developmental disabilities probably experience mental health issues at a huge proportion. Their estimates of over 40% of the people with cognitive impairment also have mental health issues. But because of the cognitive impairment, these mental health issues are frequently overlooked. There are very few resources in the community that will address mental health issues for people with cognitive impairments, practitioners that will refuse to see them. What we were interested in is if this does get expanded into 430 area of statute, that on line 18 that we eliminate the term physical disabilities, so that in fact what we're doing is also addressing some of the approaches that are necessary to provide mental health services to individuals with cognitive impairments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Thanks for the three of you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3226. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3227. And we're gonna wrap this up at 10:30, and I mean 10:30. So we'll invite Jim Davis and Wilma Gritton forward and ask you to limit your comments to 2 minutes apiece.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Wilma has left the building. I think she has made her comments, and she thinks that's enough. And in her testimony, she comments on both bills in the testimony and the support that she gets for both. And I know Verna Porter has another bill up now, so I will go ahead and just briefly cover this. Again, I'm Jim Davis, for the record. I'm today representing United Seniors, Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, Save Oregon Seniors, and the Great Panthers. And again, we're part of the Coalition for Responsible Treatment, as I discussed earlier. And this is a CART bill, and part of the process that we discussed earlier in the terms of the forums that we held. And it was just a feeling on the part of our coalition partners that there should be a task force developed on mental health and addiction services for the underserved populations, primarily seniors, people with disabilities, and certainly I would strongly support, you know, involving people with developmental disabilities as well as physical disabilities as well, and also ethnic minorities. This is what makes up our coalition,
And these are underserved populations that we would like to see some very serious planning and efforts made to develop, again, a future vision and to try to involve key individuals in planning around this. You can see the makeup of the task force includes representatives from includes legislators, but also representatives from DHS, SPD, AAAs, mental health, and SPD consumers, key advocacy groups. We would have an opportunity to really sit down and discuss and deal with this very serious issue. Our hope is that the task force can be a grassroots effort with strong coordination coming from the advocacy and consumer communities. And with this in mind, we would again love to see the subsequent referral to Ways and Means removed from this and have this really just be a community effort. But I know that there's a little more of a stretch, and I know that we would have to get agreement on the part of the department for their willingness to work with us within their current budget and with the community, as I say, the grassroots taking on a major share of the effort around this. So if we could, you know, have the same rule you applied to the other bill, but this one might be a little tougher go, but we would like to see if the department would be willing to work with us and that we could remove the fiscal, because we know that if there is a fiscal, it's going down. I don't think I need to go into any more detail on the mental health and alcohol and drug concerns of seniors and people with disabilities, and just have you concentrate just for a brief moment on page 2 and top of page 3 of the testimony, where we really have tried to incorporate the ethnic minority community who we're partnering with in this coalition, because they are suffering many of the same issues in the mental health and addiction system that our populations are. So it was a very logical partnership, just as there could be other partnerships such as the developmental disability community. The Surgeon General's report, if you ever want to look that up on the internet, really goes into some real detail about racial and ethnic minorities getting the least and the worst mental health care. And what they find in that report is that 21% of all Americans suffer from mental illness, second only to heart disease and as a cause of disability. But they found that African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and Asian Americans have some of the highest rates of mental illness and are some of the most likely to not receive services, which sounds very similar to the message we were giving before. And that, as I discussed before, there's some serious roadblocks that ethnic minorities are experiencing in accessing mental health and addiction services. There is discrimination in the system often at times here or there, or just a lack of ability to be able to respond in an appropriate manner to different cultural backgrounds. But they do experience difficulty within these systems, and so we would like to see them partnering with us, you know, particularly looking at, you know, adequate health professionals, adequate services, you know, taking care of language needs, cultural relevant and community-based type of services. So together, what we're looking at as a goal for this task force is the development of strategies geared towards the creation of just a basic system of mental health and alcohol and drug services for the underserved populations, particularly these three underserved populations, and there's some kind of coordination within the Department of Human Services and the mental health system, drug and alcohol system, and senior disability system towards developing some kind of approach and process for planning, strategizing, and then ultimately reaching out to these populations with adequate services. So the result of the task force activities can also be, you know, education and outreach and maybe creating stronger advocacy efforts on behalf of these disadvantaged populations. So we'd love to be able to get this group together on an ad hoc basis over a certain period of time to begin to look at this issue and then prepare what would be a report that we could give back to the legislature and to the state bureaucracy to let them know what needs there are within these underserved populations and begin hopefully to do some planning and strategizing that we could come back in the next session with.
Okay. Questions or comments? Okay. All right. Thanks, Jim.
You bet. Thank you.
Michael Morris.
Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Mike Morris. I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I'm here to testify in regards to House Bill 3227. And again, we are supportive of the concept of this task force and the goals of the task force. And however, we do acknowledge that there is a fiscal impact. It does require four staff from the Department of Human Services as well as support staff to staff this particular task force. And so because of that, we are taking a neutral position on this bill.
Do you suppose there's a way to design a task force like this without a fiscal?
Mr. Chair, we have looked at, there have been several task forces that have come up during this session, and so we've been instructed to look at what the actual impact within our office would be to man a task force such as this one is outlined, especially when it requires specific staff to be involved.
What'd you come up with?
We came up with approximately $117,000.
To get a couple of people together to have three or four meetings?
I could provide you with details as far as how they came up with those, that particular figures.
I would like those details.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Gina Furman.
Chair Dalto, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The association is very supportive of the concept of this bill. We think it's a good idea to get people together and talk, and we're supportive of the goals outlined, and we certainly would participate. Our main concern is we know how much time it takes for DHS staff, and we would not want any treatment dollars redirected into talking. So our main concern is the fiscal and how we do this. And if we can get around that and figure that, we're more than happy to participate.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3227 and adjourn the meeting.
3 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.